So hi and welcome to another episode of the Movies You Love podcast, and once again you might just be hearing the sultry sounds of outside Kingston, Jamaica, as I decided, what the hell, I'm not closing my windows. But otherwise, this is the latest episode where I get to sit down and talk with Mr. Jake Cole. He is a writer for Slant Magazine, Spectrum Culture, Film.com, as well as a senior editor over at the Movie Mezzanine, and he also has his own personal blog over at armchairc.blogspot.com, which you guys should definitely check out. This guy is a writing juggernaut, and sometimes I wonder how he's able to keep it all up and going all the while. So when I finally got to invite him on after meeting him for the first time in Toronto this year, I was very curious as to what he would select as the film for us to discuss this week. And can I tell you, I'm so pleased because he went all out with The Red Shoes. I mentioned it in the episode, and it's so true. It's still the only film I've seen by these directors, Paul and Pressburger. And I know I need to watch more, and I'm going to soon. I promise. I totally promise. But this movie is fantastic. It's amazing, and we have so much to talk about with it. So I'm going to let you just go straight into the episode. And as usual, just kind of as a note, go rate and review the show over on iTunes. It'd really be a help. It'd really be a testament. And, you know, send out a tweet or something. Say you like it, or I guess don't. But it'd be fun. Anyways, otherwise, enjoy the show, and here we go. Did I really do that? I did. I'm sorry. Now enjoy.
I thought once, Mr. Lermontov, that there would be no room in my life for anything but dancing.
You will think so again, Malia.
You're jealous of her.
Yes, I am.
But in the way that you will never understand.
Hey, Jake, how are you doing? So glad that you took the time to come and talk with me today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So this week you wanted to take me and my listeners into the realm of Powell and Pressburger. I'm hoping I'm not messing up those names because I am horrible at this sometimes.
I'm the absolute worst. My whole Toronto experience when I was up there for TIFF was saying the names of directors out loud and just being corrected nonstop by people who've actually seen them come to town and had Q&As, and I've only ever seen the names written down. So I pronounced everything wrong, and everyone let me know.
Well, you know, it happens, especially with foreign names. Like I'm assuming I can get away with it because they're British. So, yeah. So anyways, this week we're going to be talking about the 1948 film, The Red Shoes. I want to start where I start with all of my guests, which is obviously this is a film that you were not alive to see theatrically when it was first released. But I'm kind of curious as to tell me about the first time you actually saw this film.
It was, I want to say, I'm currently 24 years old. I want to say that I was 19 going on 20 when I first saw it. And I had just, by that time, I was already pretty serious into film. And I think the reason I watched it was because Martin Scorsese is a huge freak for the film. And we can get into that later because it's a massive topic, as anything to do with Scorsese's cinephilia is. But I just sought it out because he's talked a lot of times about that he's specifically quoted it. I can think of at least two or three films where he's explicitly referenced it. And so I just sat down and watched it. I believe it was my first Powell Pressburger. Or was it A Matter of Life or Death? It was definitely my first color Powell Pressburger, which is an important distinction. But I think it was my first overall, but it basically, I had already been into film, but then when I watched this movie, it just exploded what I thought films could have for me. Like, it basically changed the way I look at films and what I want to get out of them.
How exactly did this film change what you looked for in a film?
Oh boy, where to start? I think because before I saw that film, obviously, like, I had been into film. I had seen a lot of classics in high school, but I wasn't that into film. And when I graduated high school, right before I went to university, I watched Seven Samurai, and that was like my first big serious cinephile moment. And I would have talked about that, but I think that basically just started the ball rolling. It didn't really jumpstart it the way Red Shoes did. And I think when I got to the Red Shoes, the reason it had the impact it did was that going into it, I think I viewed style in a different way than I do now. Like, there's that saying, you know, style over substance is kind of a lazy criticism to me, that it's typically employed when people kind of maybe don't know how to explain style or don't know how style is an integral part of film, that I think sometimes people can get fixated on the themes or the plots or the characters, which are all important things, but they're also easier to explain because we all took English classes. We maybe didn't all go to film school. Like, I didn't go to film school. I mean, a lot of people didn't. So it's much easier to talk about, say, what are the literary themes of a film versus what language is it employing, because a lot of us don't have that grounding. And I think going into it, I saw a lot of films where I thought, okay, well, this looks flashy, but what's the point? Like, I don't like the story or whatever. And I think when I watched this film, it very much clarified that style is substance, that style is very much an integral part of what a film is saying, how it's saying it, and basically what point of view it's taking. I think this was the first film that more or less taught me, and it's such a belated lesson to learn, but it's the film that taught me that the camera is a subjective participant. It isn't necessarily just something that exists to be there to document, to just film action. That how a film is shot can determine the tone of the film. Obviously, like, genre films have a certain language, dramas have a certain language, but beyond that, just like what specific point of view is this film taking? And this film more or less opened all of that for me.
That is something which I find more and more relevant to my to what I'm thinking about day to day. I think it might just be because recently I've kind of delved a very deep dip into the pool of cinephilia, because I started to go through the Mark Cousins documentary, The Story of Film. And mm-hmm. and like, I've always kind of been on the tipping point of that conversation about the actual study of film versus just the entertainment value of it or the understanding of it, because so much of what I realize people converse about is like what you were saying about the literary themes as opposed to the visual cinematic themes of a film. And a lot of those people, and this isn't really to be any form of condescending, just kind of noting it more, is that they, when you start to make that distinction to them, that they start to shrug it off as quote unquote film snobbery, right?
Yes.
And that, while that can be true to a certain extent, where you're starting to take conversation into another area, which you probably didn't have it in the first place, where it wasn't necessarily a reason to go there in that particular context, it is still a valued conversation. And the style over substance thing is exactly that. I'm glad that you brought that up, because this movie is weirdly, like, this is actually the only Paul von Pressburger film I've seen, and this is the second time I'm watching it. I should go back and watch more, but, you know, I have bad instincts sometimes. Something stops me from doing these things. But I'm curious for you, like, you talked a lot about the camera no longer being an objective or just a voyeur. It's actually a part of the story and the understanding of the perspective of the film in more than just a metaphysical angular sense of just showing you something in a really nice way. What exactly about this film, and maybe about the rest of film as you move forward, did you kind of start to draw out of that point of view?
Well, a couple of things. I think the main one, for obvious reasons, and you've seen it, if anyone listening has seen it, is that very, 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 very few films can claim to use color as well as this film does. The only, in fact, I can think of, most of the ones that can do it better are other Powell Pressburger films, like Black Narcissus being potentially the all-time great use of color in film, or The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp being another one. But going into it, I hadn't watched a Technicolor film in a while. I mean, I've seen Singin' in the Rain. I live in Birmingham. I grew up near Atlanta, Georgia, and my mother was always a freak for Gone with the Wind. Like, that was her favorite book. That's her favorite movie. She's been to costume balls, which is just its own thing that we don't have. But I had seen Technicolor, but I had not processed the idea that, because Technicolor obviously is a technology. It was just something, it was the way that color was processed. But I think because now color stock is just innate, or now not even stock, now we're on digital, that you almost don't consider that the arduousness of Technicolor basically meant that it was another part of composition. And I don't think until that point I realized, like, oh yeah, Technicolor, or color in general, is a part of that. It isn't just what happened to be on set. Like, things weren't colored that brightly in 1950s film or 40s film or whatever, just because that's what was there. Like, it, for some reason, I never thought about that. I just thought, oh, I guess they just had to use all these bright things so the color would work, as opposed to that. I'm sure that was that's obviously part of it. And the three-strip process renders color in a certain way that's not realistic. But I never processed that. That actually opens up possibilities that, in a way, now you can't, very few films now could get away with, because very few filmmakers would dare to use color in that way. I mean, you still get some filters. So, Nicholas, oh God, I'm going to butcher it. Just the Drive guy. Let's just say the Drive guy. Cause
Nicholas Winding Refn.
Yeah, there we go. He can use color filters, or, Michael Mann in some earlier stuff, like Manhunter, or things like that. And Martin Scorsese obviously uses color very well, but very few people use it as expressively. And I think looking at The Red Shoes, I realized, oh, okay, I get it now. Like, color is another form of expression. It can be manipulated in a certain way. It can mean something beyond just being there.
So as I've already mentioned, I am merely on the tipping point of this kind of thought process towards film, and it's something that I'm battling with, because even as you talk about the color in this film, and I know that it's the technology of Technicolor at the time, 1948, it was pretty much the beginning point of people making color a standard in filmmaking at the time. A lot of films that I see from this point in time, like, a lot of them tend to look the same to me, in that they have this brightness to them, where I almost, like, my mental understanding of it at first was that the filmmakers themselves didn't comprehend very well how to make a set colored unless it was so contrasted between everything. It felt almost like someone was doing a drawing, and, you know, you have the borders of everything is set out, and because they don't want any of the borders to be kind of blurred into something else, they have to make everything contrast perfectly with something else. I hope I'm not mixing myself up or anything. I'm not making much sense. But it's just a weird visual idea of how this movie looks and how movies of this time looked. I mean, you mentioned Singin' in the Rain. I'd also kind of throw out another movie which I feel uses color brilliantly, which I think is from like a couple years after. I could be a decade off. It's The West Side Story, one of my favorite musicals.
I think that's like 1960. Oh my Lord, I can't remember. I don't know.
I can never remember if it's 1960 or 1950. It's actually 1961. My mistake. So yeah, they definitely had a lot more time to kind of decide on how to utilize color differently. But the style of this movie, I feel, is more thematically visual than anything else, as opposed to just, at least for me, as opposed to just kind of sticking to, oh, they use the color red a lot.
Yeah, and I think that can be an entry point, because I do think there's a certain value in just admiring the style. I don't want to sprint past that to the point of saying, well, it means something. Yes, but I also think there are certain shots in this film, and I've seen this movie maybe 7 or 8 times. I mean, not as much, for something that's probably my favorite film, I have not obsessed over it in the way that I, you know, when I was a child, I would watch a terrible movie 12 times because I was a child. But every time I watch this movie, there are certain shots in it that I just stop and I go, oh, you can't say anything. And even when I know there's meaning to it, like my favorite shot is a shot that I'll probably go into a little bit more detail just in a second, just in a different topic. But the one where when she dances, when Moira Shearer dances and the audience turns into ocean waves, that shot, no matter how many times I see that movie, I'm in awe of that shot. And it means a great deal to the thematic point of that movie, but just the aesthetic properties of it are mind-boggling.
Weirdly enough to me, the moment visually, which I kind of hone in on, like, before I get to some of the more central elements of the film, you know, like the actual ballet and stuff like that, is there's this moment that we see with Vicky and the composer, why can't I remember his name right now? I have the Craster. And they're out on the balcony and they see the train come by and you see the smoke just go over them. And it's a moment which is repeated later on in the film when you see Vicky jump over the balcony and the smoke goes over. And it's just like, it's one of those moments where I can just point to and I can say, this is definitely a moment where something is going on that I should be noting and I should be finding something strangely special about what this visual is telling me about the smoke, about the technology, about the time. But maybe it's because I'm just not ready to go that far into the film study that I can't quite put a finger on it as to how to properly describe it or how to properly dissect it. And things like that kind of stand between me and movies like this sometimes. But at the same time, is it wrong that I feel almost vindicated that I can spot the moment, even if I can't dissect it?
No, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, there are many, many aspects of film to which I remain completely ignorant. Like I said, I have not been to film school. When we were talking about Technicolor, I don't even want to broach that subject because I know so little about its actual history that I would be terrified to volunteer any guesses as to what people were thinking at the time. Because I mean, there has been actual scholarly work done, obviously, on the history of film, the history of its technology. And there's so many blind spots for me. And I think the first step is always to recognize there is something there and there is something bigger than just the experience of watching it. I think sometimes, and I'm going to sound possibly condescending, but then again, anyone who's ever followed me on Twitter knows that's sort of a hazard of following me. But I think people sometimes are willing to let movies just happen to them. They're not really willing to be invested. And when they are, they're invested in sometimes the worst way, like the way of if someone comes out against the Dark Knight, with no matter how reasoned the critique is, it hurts them somehow. Like if they take personal umbrage to it, or if someone likes something that they don't like, those kinds of things come out as sort of angry, but it's not really an engagement with the film. It's almost an engagement with the idea of it. And I think part of the thing that I try to do with my film writing, which has been more or less a self-taught venture. I've basically just written and written and written and tried to improve through paying more attention, reading some other people, broadening my horizons by looking for other films. It's to slowly kind of develop what it is I'm looking for in film. And I think films like this open it up because it's no longer, as I said earlier, it's no longer about simply sitting there and looking for, okay, well, this happens, and maybe it means this. It's no longer about actions defining the film. It's about how it describes those actions. I mean, in the same way that I think that's a flaw. I can't speak to Canadian education or British education, but I think a real flaw of American English teaching or of just literary teaching is that we process books in the most facile way. We process them by what's it saying. So when we read A Tale of Two Cities, we have to break down a character in terms of, okay, I can't remember the characters' names in Tale of Two Cities, but the one who's the prisoner who ultimately dies for the other, for his lookalike, you know, he's defined as this very sad man, very lonely, and you write a book report on that. You don't write a book report on the language Dickens uses, or even if you read Ulysses, which is a book that exists only as a work of language. If you try to break Ulysses, a plot summary of Ulysses is pointless, because it's all about the telling of this very basic story. And I think because of that, when people watch movies, even though typically the same people who will not pay attention in English class are the people who are not going to go watch art movies, I think the principle is the same. I think bad education on that level, in some ways, infects is a strong word, but whatever, infects the way we handle movies.
Do you think that it goes a step further to infect the way people construct films?
Possibly. I think that's cast. I mean, granted, it's casting a wide net to assume that weak English teaching is the reason we have bad movies, but I do think to a certain extent, it's hard to say, because we actually live in, we live in a bizarre time movie wise where even on the studio level, the auteur theory is basically one. So big name people like David Fincher or Spielberg or what have you, they actually command clout. And to a certain extent, I mean, Martin Scorsese can still get his film completely recut by Harvey Weinstein, but, by and large, those people do command things in a way that they might not have in what we call the golden age, because basically then you were defined by, do you shoot it on time? Do you shoot it on budget? And generally, the reason the auteur theory blossomed out of that was people who were working under immense constraints producing works of art. And now, basically, the system, ever since New Hollywood, even in the 80s to a certain extent, although it took a huge nosedive and it kind of came back in the 90s, it's built around auteurs. But at the same time, I think those auteurs, some of them, or some people who want to be them, will reduce it to themes. I mean, we process it like that. So a lot of, I do think there are a lot of films now that basically you look at them and you say, oh, okay, that character means this, or he means that, or she does this. And then you don't really focus on the visual language of film. Like, you know, we're in an entirely new era of filmmaking with digital, and it should open up an entirely new language, because digital is in a completely different format. It obeys different rules. It isn't, the way it captures an image is fundamentally different from how film is captured. You know, film, you need a certain amount of artificial light. You need a certain setting. You need all this. Digital, it just takes a raw image, and then basically you create it through post-production. I mean, the entire process is different. And very few filmmakers are taking advantage of that. Michael Mann is one, David Fincher is one, Steven Soderbergh, regardless of whether he says he's retired, I don't buy that for a second. And if he stays on TV, he'll still be making cinematic quality work on television. He's another one. I mean, people who have incorporated something different with digital, and as opposed to people who are simply shooting on digital because that's the standard now, and they're trying to make it look like film when it isn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that definitely brings to mind, like, when we're talking about films like this, films that are six decades, a little bit less, no, they're more than six decades, because it's 2013, I need to learn how to do math, old and more, that the technology is something which we, like, the other day I saw for the first time Buster Keaton's Sherlock Jr., and...
Oh, that's great.
And it's something about watching those set pieces happen within the film, and you kind of have to put, like, when we go to the theater today, we almost have a visual contract, an unspoken contract that we've taken into going into the theater, where we go, all right, you're going to put some stuff on the screen which I know isn't real, but I'm already okay with it because I've already have an understanding as to how you kind of did it, right? Back then, that contract didn't exist. It was all about magical in between of how the hell did you do this? And it literally was like a magician doing things for us on the stage, right? Mm-hmm. I still feel that when I watch a movie like this, because while I still have a slight understanding of the technology of the time and how things would have been shot and how we eventually get to that end product, because I don't know if I'd use the word sadly, but I've taken so much of an investment in understanding that kind of thing. There are points in it where it almost makes me forget, where I get so invested in the visual and the thematic play that is happening in front of me that I no longer try to break it down in my head of, oh, shot A, shot B, cut there, there is where it switches to something else. Okay, that works, kind of stuff. And I don't know if you do this too, because my brain is very technical. But it's, I mean, just...
it's finished.
No, it's just a weird thing which I do when I'm watching movies sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, I do that too, and I'm not to the point of sophistication where, say, like, I could pull a David Bordwell and notice each individual shot. There are plenty of times where I just kind of get, especially on a first watch, I'm not as good at sitting down and mentally keeping tabs of it while I'm processing the story for the first time, because I do care about story. I think sometimes I might come off now, especially because of films like The Red Shoes having the effect they did on me. I think sometimes I might come off as caring only for direction, when I do think, obviously, that's one aspect of a film that must work in tandem with others, although I do think great direction can offset many, many flaws in the other departments in writing or acting or what have you. But, there are certain films, and I think for more recent films, I think I notice it more. So when I, you mentioned seeing films now versus seeing films then must have been like. I think when I watch films like The Red Shoes and when I watch films like Sherlock Jr., it's easier to see the lines, the strings that are holding people up, or there's a cut during the ballet sequence in The Red Shoes where you can clearly see where someone has basically just put on a black suit and jumped into the red shoes to dance. But it's such a, if you look closely, especially if you watch the Criterion Blu-ray with its definition, you can clearly see the outline of a person wearing all black against a black screen, and you can also see it in the Powell Pressburger film Tales of Hoffman, which is a filmed opera. It's basically, if you took the ballet sequence of The Red Shoes and more or less made an entire film out of it, you'd have the Tales of Hoffman. And there's a similar sequence in that one where I think it's also starring Moira Shearer as a wind-up mechanical girl who's slowly dismembered, and you can see her continue to dance as, like, arms are quote-unquote ripped off, but you can see the outline of where she's clearly wearing a, like, black unitard. Even though I notice it, there are so many elements where I just lose myself and I wonder, how did they pull this off? Because I know it took actual, genuine physical effort versus, say, something nowadays when you look at something now, there's none of that wonder, because you look at it and you go, how do they do that? Oh, right, CGI, that was CGI. And very, very rarely is it anything other than CGI. And so I think it's hard for me to feel magic these days when I watch new movies, because I know exactly how it was done. Like, there's no longer that joy of figuring out, oh, they had to do this in camera, or they had to film it upside down and then flip it, or they filmed it through a mirror. Like, all these old techniques that were just clever on-set or post-production techniques, now it's just, well, they shot a giant green screen, and then some nerd came in later, and like a floor full of nerds went in later and put a world there. Like, it's just not as impressive.
Well, I mean, that also kind of cues us into why it's such big news when we see things like production news for movies like possibly The Dark Knight or Inception, where we hear, oh, he actually flipped a truck over, or, oh, they actually built a hallway in a tube and just spun it and let them fight while it was turning upside down.
I know, and isn't it so crazy? Like, that's what passes nowadays. I honestly don't think, I rewatched these recently, and they're honestly not particularly well-made movies, but the Lord of the Ring movies are not the original, but the Peter Jackson ones compared to The Hobbit. It's so crazy to watch Lord of the Rings, which I have a lot of problems with its direction, its pacing, its structure. I mean, some of that is not Peter Jackson's fault. I don't have as much fondness for the books, but when I watch the Lord of the Rings films, I can at least admire the miniature work, the forced perspective to film all the hobbits next to Gandalf, all these things versus The Hobbit, where everything looks like Candyland. It looks like Candyland, the movie, and it just makes me so angry. I literally sat in the movie theater watching The Hobbit, fuming silently at just how disgusting it all looked, how shiny and unlived in and stupid it all looked. Like, it genuinely, that's such a lazy non-crit term, but it looked stupid. It looked like an idiot had done it and not thought to do anything other than just make it look shiny. And I sat there the whole time wondering, like, I want to go home and I want to watch something where I can see, like, I want to watch the original cut of Blade Runner where I can see the cables holding up the flying car. I want to see Metropolis, the Fritz Lang film, where you can see all these effects. I want to see something where I know someone actually physically exerted an effort somewhere, because I just don't care. Like, watching this is watching a video game that I can't play, or it's watching nothing. It's just nothing to me. It's cotton candy being passed off as a technical achievement,
I guess. But pulling back to the red shoes, I kind of want to talk about the ballet sequence, because I don't know about you, but that kind of is the centerpiece and the highlight of this film for me whenever I'm looking at it. And it's something that, watching it this time around, I was thinking about a lot. And I'm between two worlds in how I think about that ballet sequence, which is a positive and a negative thing. Positively, it just works perfectly in the film's entire thought process of going, only the music matters. And when you're listening to this music, you should be seeing this, which you hear them tell you over and over again. And when we get into that ballet sequence, we get into so many unworldly visuals as we watch Vicky dance around it, that you kind of take that away from it. But on the negative side, there's a part of me where I see things like she jumps into her red shoes and it's obviously a cut from the film, or she's dancing with a paper and it just cuts to an actual person dancing in a paper costume. Or where she dances around and a huge Victorian set appears, where I feel almost that the film side starts to overbear on the theatrical side of the ballet. And part of me was hoping to see some actual, very well-constructed ballet theater as opposed to just a film. And weirdly enough, I don't know why I'm thinking of that while I'm watching a film. But does that kind of... What were your thought process when you were watching this sequence, possibly for the first time, or maybe for the seventh time, as you mentioned?
I think that exactly what you're saying is exactly what broke me of my old way of thinking. Like, 'cause when I first watched it, at the start of it, I started thinking like that. I could see, oh, obviously there's a cut there, or... when there's that scene where it flickers between a guy and a shadow, and when it light comes on it, it's either Craster or Anton Walbrook, and you know, so it flashes on, and you can see it cuts to put the actual actor in place of this shadow person, and you can tell it. But as I watched it, I thought, how to put this, I basically had my epiphany during that sequence, which was, by not shooting it as a ballet, by not just pulling the camera back and filming in the way that really great old dance movies do, you get to see the dancers dance. It's not this current kind of cut-up style where, you know, barring the step-up films, like, when people dance on film now, it's cut up in such a way that you don't have to see how bad the people who were cast for being stars and not for being dancers are. But when you watch something like Singin' in the Rain, or any Fred Astaire movie, any Gene Kelly film, you get to see them in full. And I think in this film, obviously, it's more cut up, but it's not cut up in the way that it is now. But yes, it is. It's more frantically edited. It's more isolated. It's usually Vicky alone in frame, and or a dancer will come in and make a very brief appearance with her, and then it'll be firmly back on Vicky. And even when the dancer's on screen, the camera is still very close to her. And I think what I love about that is that the entire dance scene is not about watching her dance. It's not about, because she can't watch herself dance, but it is about her in the moment of dancing. It is entirely her subjective experience of being in that ballet. So the camera is looking at her, but it is in effect a POV shot through her eyes. And I think that was the first film that made me realize that a point of view shot or a perspective shot does not have to be a first person shot, an eye line match, what have you. It merely has to reflect how that person perceives things. I mean, there are entire films that stare at a person that are in effect POV films. Eric Rohmer's My Night at Maud's is one, which is an entirely chatty film, but you see the world the way that its pretentious, faux religious protagonist sees it. And I think it was this film that made me realize, and this sequence in particular, where you see her, that cut of her jumping into the shoes, it does produce a bit of cognitive dissonance, because you go, oh, I saw that. And, you know, today that would be, we would consider that a mistake. And maybe even then it was considered a mistake to have a cut that visible. But I think looking at it, the break that it provides makes it's a snap between seeing her in that moment and then seeing her as she becomes that role, as she becomes she all of a sudden inhabits that world of dance, which ends with, like I said earlier, the camera does pull back and you think it's going to be an objective shot. We're going to see everything, but the entire crowd has been replaced with a superimposed image of the ocean, and their applause has been made to sound like ocean waves, because in that moment, she cares so little for anyone else in the world. It's just about her dancing. It's not about her dancing for money or fame or accolades or anything. It's just about her dancing because she has to dance. She has to express herself in that manner. And I think the reason that sequence is shot like that is because it is 100% within her perspective.
You see, the moments like these are when I realize that I'm a bad cinephile, because through all of that moment of you talking about that scene, like, I was just thinking, I think David Bowie should pop in here and just tell us how we should dance. I'm a bad person. But yeah, I totally understand that, and I agree with you 100%, because it's exactly what I was saying as well as that, where her point of view was through the music, which created that area for her, right? Mm. And that's exactly what happened in the film. That's why we start to see that point when Craster and the other guy, whose name I should be able to point out here, Anton Walbrook, who just become the, as they are, the conductors and the producers of this world that she's able to dance in, which is when it becomes slightly horrorish, when you're like, oh, so someone is constructing a world for me. What if they constructed a bad world? Which is what kind of happens in The Red Shoes, when it becomes a nightmare of itself. When as the story of The Red Shoes goes, she's unable to stop dancing because the shoes themselves start to dance for her. And you see all of this imagery of the shoemaker who casts this big shadow who seems to control her. You see all of these moments where it becomes a visual feel. And that's why I kind of love the ballet sequence, even though I kind of had that moment of thinking of it poorly, which was just kind of like, what if I thought about it this way? But that might just be the wrong way to think about it. Which is that the movie at that point stops being the narrative expository film and starts being a completely visual cinematic film. Like, if it was never that for anyone else before that point in time, that section of the ballet is the point in time which shows that, that person that there is something other than the narrative film as it stands.
Right.
But thinking about the film as it progresses after the ballet, even when we come to the reprisal of the ballet again, and Vicky actually killing herself as she jumps over the railing, jumps over the balcony. That moment when we see the ballet again without Vicky, where without anyone dancing in that role of the girl in the red shoes, like, how did that play for you when you first saw this film? Because that is such a emotionally draining feeling for me.
Yeah, it's very, I mean, it honestly disturbs me. It disturbed me then, and in some ways, every time I still watch it, when the spotlight just follows where she should be, it's very, I mean, the end to me is very chilling because, you know, when you see the spotlight following where she should be, obviously it can no longer be, it's the first moment since maybe the beginning of the film when the theater goers are filing in that the camera adopts an objective position. And it's such a hard break from it. It's almost a psychological tear because now you're completely disconnected from the brain that you were in, the mind, the soul that you were in the entire time. And all of a sudden it just looks so wrong because that's a point where the camera pulls back and there's just nothing there anymore. And you can read it as if the show must go on. I mean, that's the literal depiction of it because they just, obviously they do a performance without the lead star. I mean, and if you want to be one of those pedantic people, I'm sure you could say, well, why didn't they just bring the understudy? Everyone has one, but that's really not the point. The point is, you know, it pulls away from her perspective all of a sudden, and the film is very radically changed in those last few seconds because of it.
It's kind of weird that, for me, something about that moment when Walbrook steps out on stage and shouts at the top of his voice with what we can honestly believe is, like, true shock, and I don't know, is there a little grief in there, announcing to the audience that Victoria won't be dancing tonight or ever again, that I kind of always get stopped in my, like, in my mental process of trying to going with the film, like, I go, oh shit, this is just a moment, and it's one of those moments that stuck with me forever since I saw this film for the first time.
It's a really hard, because I think he's absolutely in grief, and I think his grief is compounded because I think the film is nominally set up as kind of a love triangle between him and her and Craster, but I really don't think his intent, he's never really romantic with her. It's a strange kind of love triangle that's actually way more complex than most love triangles are in modern movies, because it's, on one hand, there's both of the men in her life provide her with a certain creative outlet. Craster writes the music, Walbrook's character produces, and he's the impresario. They both give her something outside of just romance, and only one of them truly has any real romantic feelings for her, yet it's the other one who protects her fiercely because it's almost like those old, all these old kind of very misogynistic fairy tales or just tales of kinds where a woman's virginity is basically tied to mystical powers. If you want a more recent example, the Bond film Live and Let Die is one where Jane Seymour's character can read the future through tarot cards until Bond sleeps with her and she loses that power, which is but the same principle, I think, is in this film. I would say his character is as manipulative as those kinds of characters, but he has such a fierce protection of her basically physical purity because he's afraid that if she is distracted by anything, that if she ceases to live 100% for her art, that she will cease to be as good as she is. And I think in the end, he realizes that by forcing her to commit 100%, because basically, as much as it's presented as her not being able to choose between them, I think we can all safely say that he's more responsible, that him basically threatening to destroy the thing that she loves, to bar her from the thing that she loves most if she dares to live like a human being, is what basically destroys her before she actually kills herself. And I think in that moment he realizes that by accepting absolutely no compromise, he's now left with zero. By demanding all or nothing, he's now been left with nothing.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious, though. It's been 5 or more years, as I've said repeatedly, I'm bad with math, since you first saw this film. How is it that over that period of time, not so much this film has changed, but gradually with each viewing, you have changed in what you started to critique other films about?
It's funny, because when I come back to it, this is the film that basically set me on the path that I'm at now, because before I saw this film, I think I had seen Rebel Without a Cause in high school, because that's, even high school now just shows it, and I think that's just a thing they do, but I didn't really process it outside of course, like, okay, that's James Dean, he looks cool, he's crying, his dad's an emasculated, blah, 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 Sal Mineo's gay, like, you know, these very simple, reductive things that you can easily reduce the film to, but they're all fundamental aspects of the movie, but you don't really learn how to tie them together until you can process Nicholas Ray's the style of that movie. And I think it was after I saw this film that I went back and started watching Nicholas Ray films. I watched I rewatched Rebel Without a Cause. I watched Bigger Than Life. Eventually I watched all of them, but like those are the films that I watched first. And because The Red Shoes taught me to pay attention to what the use of color might be saying, what the camera placement might say about its interior world as much as its objective documented one or its exterior observed world, those films started to be opened up to me in an incredible way. And I think it expanded basically what I look for. So, and it's not necessarily just stylish films in those sense. It's not necessarily colorful ones in that way. John Ford now is my absolute favorite director. The director of The Searchers, Young Mr. Link. I mean, I could list at least 15 names of films that I would consider some of the greatest films ever made. I mean, his career was very long, very storied. And I had watched The Searchers and My Darling Clementine and Stagecoach and I think one other, I can't remember now, but I watched those films when I was 18 and I did not care. I mean, it's not that I didn't care for them. I could recognize they were well made in that general vague sense of saying, okay, I understand that this was well put together, but I could not articulate any of it yet. And I went back to those films after this one, I eventually made my way back to them and I realized that they are masterpieces of direction in the way that this film having the before and after I think of this film, and I think it's this film that was the crux of it, is what actually made me pay attention to directors. Previously, I loved, you know, I already had favorite directors like Kurosawa and Scorsese, I mean, very stylish directors, but I couldn't articulate what it was about that style, and I think I just basically would lump them under a general heading of just being stylish, and I think it was this film that made me pay attention to the actual directorial trademarks, what they communicated, what they were saying. And so when I come back to this film, having started to process films in that way, and thus by watching as many films as I can and thinking about them in those terms, further articulating what it is about those films that entrances me, that makes me excited, that makes me want to write about them or talk about them, coming back to this film and especially seeing other Archer's films, is that I notice more and more just how intricately plotted it is. And not in terms of its story, but how intricately woven its visual elements are, how they feed off of each other, how the use of red isn't just, you know, everyone just says, oh, well, red's passionate. Yeah, but that's, and, you know, I mean, there's so many uses of red. You can have Suspiria's use of red where it's just a slaughterhouse, or you can have the use of red in this film, or you can have the use of red in Rebel Without a Cause. Like, they all generally communicate passion of a sort, but they communicate it in vastly different ways, and they mean different things. And I think coming back to this film every so often, it makes me realize, just how much these kinds of films have to give, because I see something new in this film every single time. And it helps me in that sense. I never consider what I think about a film to be my last word on it. And that's general. I mean, that can get on a general tangent, but I just think that, especially because I'm young and I don't know everything or even anything, the more that I come back to things that I originally dismissed or even enjoyed and sometimes now hate, or when I enjoyed them and I come back and I can explain why I enjoy them and I love them even more because I can actually articulate myself in, to some extent. It's because, I mean, it's because coming back to films like these make me realize that, oh, I don't know everything. I don't know. There are certain aspects, even of films that I can talk about and can write about to a certain length, there will always be new things, and there will always be things that I maybe wasn't in the right frame of mind, I maybe wasn't at the right level of emotional maturity or of understanding, a cinematic understanding or just artistic understanding, and coming back to them opens up new things.
Okay. Like, that feels like one thing that I draw out of that moment that you were explaining to me is that it seems more and more like, obviously, that you're getting into that higher level of art discussion around film. And I'm kind of curious as to what your response is generally to what I mentioned earlier in the conversation about it being slightly shrugged off sometimes as film snobbery. Like, how do you allow yourself to enter into that conversation and at the same time try to possibly reach out to those who have yet made that epiphany? Or do you not? I don't know.
I do. Honestly, I genuinely do. I mean, I can be, well, anyone who follows me is going to laugh. I can very much be standoffish about the things that I get angry about. Like, although I do try to minimize it. Like, I threw my fair share of pot shots at Gravity, a film that I don't care for at all, but I've tried to avoid talking about it. Now that I've written like one or two things about it, I've just shut down. I don't have any real, if anyone likes it, I don't care. Like, that's just move on. Like, people like what they like. But at the same time, that just makes me redouble my efforts to promote things that I do think are good, which I think is a much more noble purpose for criticism than just getting on a high horse for however long. It's fun for a while to take, you know, to make jokes on Twitter or whatever. But in the end, I do try not to bring people to my way of thinking in the sense of like, oh, you need to look at it this way, because that's pretentious and that's the exact wrong way to approach how to promote films, because we all bring our own thing. In fact, I would rather hear someone watch it and find something different in it and tell me about it, and then I can go look and see if I see the same thing, than to tell people, no, watch it this way, or watch it under these conditions, or watch it again until you agree with what I think. You know, that can happen. And sometimes you don't even mean to be condescending about it. You just cared so deeply about a film that you just say, No, you've got to see it like this. If you don't like it, like, because you want people that you care about or that you like or that you, or that you admire to be on the same wavelength, because then it makes you feel good. It makes you feel like, okay, we're all on the same page, or, you know, if it's people that you look up to, if you agree, then you go, oh, well, then I'm smart like them, or what have you, or if it's someone that's, you know, that if you just like the company of, or you like talking to, it gives you more to talk about. But I don't really, I always try to promote the things that I love. I will always promote The Archers to people, because I think that they are certainly of that era of filmmakers, because that era of film is acted differently, it's written differently, it's shot differently because of the time period that it was shot in, the technological state of cinema, the nature of how people viewed acting then as a of screenwriting. You know, now we have different measures of quality, and which is not to say that new films are bad or old films are bad, but that we process what we consider good is not what was considered good 40 years ago. It's an entirely different template. You know, now we look at actors based on how versatile they are, whereas that's a very new concept. If you look at people like Cary Grant or John Wayne or Katharine Hepburn, these are people who basically played the same role their whole lives, and we consider them the greatest actors and actresses ever, rightly so. I think they are timeless talents. But now you wouldn't, now we make fun of people who play just the same role. So if like Keanu Reeves comes up, and I'm not saying Keanu Reeves deserves to be placed on even the same bookshelf, much less the same row as Katharine Hepburn or Cary Grant, but I do think that people who make fun of him for being one note are missing A, much bigger problems with Keanu Reeves' acting, and B, that's not necessarily a flaw. And I think, and then that's just a minor, that's one part of it, or if you look at screenwriting. So there's always going to be ways of looking at a film, your own the context of your time, the context of the time that was made, your own personal experiences, and so as much as I love promoting things, and maybe as a critic, I should try harder to, but I think people come to things in their own time, and I think trying to force it down someone makes it into schoolwork. And I remember from when I was in school, I love to read. I love to read anything. I read, you know, I've read Joyce on my free time. But if I had to read Ulysses in school, I guarantee you I wouldn't have read it. I guarantee you I would have shut down because if I had to read 30 pages by the next class period, I would never have read it. I just would have gone to Spark Notes or I would have gone online. So I think by making it into coursework, you don't do anyone any favors, because if people are remotely like me, and I hope to God they're not, because someone has to function normally in this society, but if they are at all like me, having it crammed down your throat is not going to open it up.
Part of me is happy to hear someone else use Spark Notes in their lifetime. but otherwise, I don't think there's much else we can do with this film. I just want to say thank you so much for coming in and talking with me tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
So that was the episode, all sorts of madness and all, even discussing things like actual trying to comprehend and understanding film criticism and film, I hate to use this word, snobbery, and just basic comprehension of film entirely, as something that I've kind of tried to wrangle, is that a word I'd use, as something I've been trying to come to terms with in my own understanding of film, and I feel it's more and more the reason why I've been kind of lazed with my writing as late, but I'm gonna get back to that. I need to get back to that, but otherwise it's a great episode. I think I should probably stop saying that. I should probably stop self-eulogizing my own podcast, but you guys, thank you for listening. Thank you so much. I want to thank Jake for coming on. Go follow him on Twitter. He's at Not Just Movies, which, like, great. And go tell him you listen. Go tell him you love hearing his voice. Go tell him do more podcasts, because he really should. I need to make a whole podcast just for Jake Cole. But otherwise, thanks so much for listening. Go rate and review the show over on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you listen. Go leave me a comment on the website over at gmanreviews.com. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Thank you so much for listening, and good night.